All right, everybody, and welcome to
Terror of the Tales.
And today is Fallout Week. Woo, yeah.
I have no idea what Fallout is.
What? It's a video game.
Well, I know that much, but I don't know what it is about.
Actually, to be honest,
fan fiction will help understand what it is.
Yes, hopefully. I know it's a game. I think it's about the end of the world game, I think.
Yeah.
I haven't really actually sat down and played any of the Fallout games. I've heard they're really good, though.
It's playing Pokemon, so.
Isn't that pretty much all your understanding of games is? It's just Pokemon?
Final Fantasy, Tales of, Harvest Moon. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't extend much, do you?
Well, I did try playing Halo, but I ended up getting crushed by an elevator, and the only kill I actually got was by suicide bombing. Could never figure out how to throw the grenade, so I would just kind of blow up.
Nice.
I ended up dying a lot.
You usually just throw that. Usually you have a button that's like the throw grenade button.
Oh, well, unfortunately, I apparently did not throw them, or I did throw them, and I just kind of ended up in the blast radius.
Wow. Yeah. That is, I'm going to say special.
I mean, you know, I try.
I see. So let's get this started with the artichoke.
Alrighty, artichoke, take it away.
Once upon a time in the magical land of Equestria, there came an era where the ideals of friendship gave way to greed, selfishness, paranoia, and a jealous reaping of dwindling space and natural resources. Lands took up arms against their neighbors. The end of the world occurred much as we had predicted. The world was plunged into an abyss of balefire and dark magic. The details are trivial and pointless. The reasons, as always, purely our own. The world was nearly wiped clean of life. A great cleansing, a magical spark struck by pony hooves, quickly raged out of control. Megaspells rained from the skies. Entire lands were swallowed in flame and fell beneath the boiling oceans. Ponykind was almost extinguished, their spirits becoming part of the ambient radiation that blanketed the lands. A quiet darkness fell across the world. But it was not, as some had predicted, the end of the world. Instead, the apocalypse was simply the prologue for another bloody chapter in pony history. In the early days, thousands were spared the horrors of the Holocaust by taking refuge in enormous underground shelters known as stables. But when they emerged, they had only the hell of the wastes to greet them. All except those in Stable 2. For on that fateful day when spellfire rained from the sky, the giant steel door of Stable 2 swung closed and never reopened.
If I'm going to tell you about the adventure of my life, explain how I got to this place with these people, and why I did what I'm going to do next, I should probably start by explaining a little bit about pipbucks. What is a pipbuck? A pipbuck is a device worn on the foreleg just above the hoof, issued to every pony in a stable when they become old enough to start work. A blending of unicorn pony magic and science, your pipbuck will keep a constant measure of your health and even help administer healing pulses and other medicine, track and organize everything in your saddle packs, assist in repairs, and keep all manner of notes and maps available at a hoof tap. Plus, it allows you to listen to the stable broadcast whenever you would like, as it can tune into and decrypt just about any radio frequency. And that's not all. A pony's pipbuck generates an EFS, Eyes Forward Sparkle, that will indicate direction and help gauge whether the ponies or creatures around you are hostile. And, perhaps most impressively, a pipbuck can magically aid you in a fight for brief periods of time through the use of the SATS, Stable Tech Arcane Targeting Spell. Oh, and a feature not to be forgotten. It can keep track of the location of tagged objects or people, including the wearers of other pipbucks. So if a pony somehow got lost, don't ask me how you could get lost in a stable, but it does happen on occasion, then any pony who knew the lost pony's tag could find them instantly. It can even be made to glow like a lamp. So yes, pipbucks really are a testament to unicorn pony arcane science. And yes, having a pipbuck is a big advantage. So with how wonderful and miraculous all that just sounded, it's hard to impress upon ponies who never lived in a stable just how ordinary, how pedestrian a pipbuck was in the eyes of the ponies living in Stable 2, and why I was disappointed to have one as my cutie mark. Every pony in Stable 2 had a pipbuck. All that stuff I mentioned? Most ponies don't even use half of that. They just used it to tune into the stable broadcast, listen to the sweet, sweet voice of Velvet Remedy in the evenings, or the latest school singing competitions during the day. The stable had two soccer leagues, one of which allowed SATS and one which prohibited it. Otherwise, most ponies paid their pip bucks almost no attention at all. The Overmare issues each pony their own pip buck on the day of their cutie mark party, usually a day or two after you get the mark on your flanks that tells every pony what makes you special, what you're destined to be good at. Once it shows, the Overmare knows what work to assign you. You know your place in the stable. So no, I was not thrilled that what made me special was something that every pony had, which was a lot like being told I wasn't special at all. Sure, getting a pit buck as my cutie mark could have meant I was destined to become an awesome pit buck repair filly or something, but in reality it was like getting a cutie mark of a cutie mark. Didn't help that I was the last pony to get her cutie mark. Not surprising in retrospect. Kinda tough to find what you're supposed to be good at when what you're supposed to be good at is something you don't get until you found what you're supposed to be good at. So I tried everything. I even tried to invent new things. As a unicorn pony myself, my innate magics allowed me a level of fine manipulation that earth ponies don't enjoy. Any pony can hold a key in their teeth and open a lock, but using multiple tools in a very delicate operation? That requires precision levitation. So I decided to learn to pick locks with a bobby pin and screwdriver, and I was even getting pretty good at it. Unfortunately, it didn't get me my cutie mark. It just got me in trouble. I even, to my humiliation, went through the CAT, Cutie Mark Aptitude Test, in the hopes it would guide me to what made me special. But no, my CAT was utterly average, with only marginally higher scores in a couple areas, indicating I might be suited for work as a pit buck technician or a stable loyalty inspector. Two options, I should note, that were even less impressive when you consider that it was generally expected that unicorn ponies would go into either technical or administrative work. That is, except the unicorn ponies who are natural artists, like Velvet Remedy. As I said before, our inherent magic allows us the sort of fine manipulation that technical work demands. Likewise, the Overmare and her government were always unicorn ponies. It is the Overmare's unicorn magic, after all, that creates the false sunlight used to grow our underground apple orchard. And while our apples might not look like those beautiful red things in the old books, they are what keep us alive. It was only because they let me try my hooves at both positions that I gained access to a pit buck before receiving my own, otherwise I might never have gotten my cutie mark. Oh, my name is Little Pip. Go figure. I was given the name because I was the youngest and the smallest, and even my mother had the good sense not to call me Pipsqueak. Not that I don't love her, but when a filly's cutie mark is a glass of hard apple cider? Anyway, funny how names like that turn out sometimes. Pleased to meet you. Here is my story.
Oh my god, my little pony! Hey! I really enjoyed this. I liked how you started off. Kind of like this really kind of like official narrative tone, and then when you switched the point of views to the unicorn pony whose name I have missed, you had that kind of less like a really personable tone, like it really felt like you were just trying to talk to us, and I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the story. I want to hear what Zane has to say. Yep.
You know, I would definitely say that this was good. I've got really nothing else left to say other than what you said.
Yeah, so he did good.
Yeah.
Did you like the story, Zane?
Yes.
Even with the ponies?
Even with the ponies. I was kind of hoping there would be bloodshed of the ponies, but...
Well, I think that maybe in the story later on there might be, but I really like the combination of Fallout with...
This is so annoying me.
What's annoying?
Oh, background.
Oh, okay. Sorry about that. Anywho!
It's not you, it's me.
Next.
Up next is... Beloved Star.
Take it away.
What was it like to die? This was the question that sat on my mind, a virus of words that spread unhindered through my thoughts, invading every moment of consciousness and every dream that I had. A question that remained unanswered with each passing step I took through the coarse desert sand. But death shouldn't be on my mind. I was still young, not even a teenager. And yet the thought of death continued to churn inside my mind. This desert, this wasteland, was cruel and unforgiving. I had been forced to recognize the harsh reality that was life. At not even 12 years of age, I knew more about this world than most. It was rational, even normal, to fear the inevitability that was death. But I didn't. Every minute beneath a baking sun, every pain of hunger I felt, every drop of water my body wished it had, brought me closer to my breaking point. I had come to accept the fate destiny had laid out before me. I no longer feared death. I longed for it. I wished for the sweet oblivion that would whisk me away from all the pain that I felt. I wanted so desperately to lay in the sand, close my eyes, and never again gaze upon the desolate world. I wanted to die, and that terrified me. Deep down, some part of me wished to find salvation, to hang on to what little hope remained and find reason to go on. But I found no reason. I had nowhere to go back to and nothing to look forward to. Death was the logical conclusion of my life. It was the best conclusion, considering the alternatives. My mother had, when I was younger, told me stories of the dangers that lurked in the vast deserts around our home. Raiders, monsters, and even the desert itself. Murder, rape, slavery, and even cannibalism were common in the wasteland. My parents had left behind society for the safety of isolation. Like every child, I had been naive, believing nothing bad would ever happen to me or my family. But I had been wrong. Everything I had ever known was taken from me. My mother, my father, my home, all were dead and gone. And I was alone. I wanted to cry, to give in to the child that I was, but my body would not allow it. I had had nothing to drink in days. My body would not allow me to waste what precious little water remained inside of me on something as foolish as tears. So I cried out in my mind, a silent lament for my lost parents, for the life destiny had forced me to live. My eyes stung, my throat burned. My mind was in turmoil, and the dehydrated husk that was me continued to move across the lonely desert. I lost touch with the world around me, seeing nothing but the pain and loss that I had suffered. I stumbled and fell down to the hot sand without so much as an attempt to stop myself. I didn't remember hitting the sand, nor how long I lay there. I was too weak to move or pick myself up off the ground. This was the end. I wasn't afraid, only curious as to what lay beyond. What would I see once I closed my eyes for the final time? Was there a heaven? Was there a hell? Would it hurt? These questions and so many more ran through my mind as I waited for my life to end, as I waited to die. Soon my suffering would end, and I would once again see my family. My only regret was that my life had been so tragically short, but I accepted my fate. Lying face down in the sand was beyond uncomfortable. I was going to die. Nothing could change that fact. But I could at least die in comfort. At the bare minimum, I could die without sand in my face. So I turned. The sun loomed to my right, so I looked to the left. And that's when I saw it. A lone speck in the distance, no larger than my thumbnail. A building in the wastes. Something sparked to life deep down inside me, the small part of me that wished for continued existence. It surged forward with a renewed strength, flowing through me from head to toe. It was then that I realized I didn't truly wish to die. I saw death as inevitable, but that didn't mean I had to accept it. I wanted to live. I wanted to see my tomorrow. I didn't want to die. Not yet. Strength I had thought long gone found its way to my limbs, and I pushed myself up from the dusty ground, ignoring the searing pain that flared in my muscles as I stood. Unbalanced, but standing, I forced my leg up and placed one foot in front of the other, and that foot in front of the first. I concentrated on this one act, thinking of nothing else. One foot in front of the other. With each passing step, the building grew larger. Then the sand was gone, and I stood among the ruins of an abandoned shack. A ruin lost to the vast desert. The walls had long ago collapsed in on themselves, and the carpet felt frayed and brittle underneath my worn sneakers. Sunlight filtered through where the roof had collapsed. Junk and debris littered the ground inside and out, accumulating in piles and stacks like artificial dunes of trash. Time had been harsh to what once had been home, but the past was the past. My survival depended on the here and now, the present, not forgotten memories of a world long gone. A collection of rusted tin cans caught my eye. They sat near a threadbare suitcase just a few feet from where I stood. I stumbled towards them and began searching, finding an inch or so of rancid water inside of one. I didn't hesitate. I downed the contents of the can in one gulp, ignoring the urge to vomit as the horrid water slid down my throat. The water, or so I hoped it was foul and disgusting, but I was beyond caring. My body was grateful for the liquid it so desperately ached for. I felt revived. Death no longer seemed to loom over me. But I knew it was only a temporary fix. I would need to find more if I wanted to survive. The suitcase seemed likely to hold something of value, so I grabbed it. The numbered lock had rusted away to almost nothing and broke apart with a small tug. Inside were several articles of clothing and a Programmer's Digest magazine. I flipped through several pages before tossing the magazine aside for later. Next, I turned my attention to a nearby heap of metal boxes resting atop a wooden pallet. The pallet was propped up on one end by a damaged footlocker, creating a small crawl space where several empty boxes of cram lay scattered. The footlocker interested me, but the weight of the pallet kept its lid firmly shut, so I ignored it and climbed atop to look through the myriad of boxes. I was a vulture picking through each and every box, though I came away empty-handed. Most were either empty or filled to the brim with trash. One contained a small skeleton of a rat whose misfortune was to become trapped inside like, well, a rat. This morbid discovery prompted me to question just how far I would go to survive. We had always had a steady supply of vegetables at home that grew with enough effort on our part, but my father would often hunt the wildlife that roamed the desert around where we lived. More often than not, it was giant mole rats. They tasted terrible and smelled just as bad, but we made do. One couldn't always have bighorn or steak for dinner. My stomach growled at the thought of food. I decided then and there that I was hungry enough to eat almost anything at this point, rat or otherwise. My luck remained in the negative as I continued to scrounge through the mountain of boxes. I was ready to forego them and investigate an old refrigerator I'd spied in a nearby room. I was about to leave when I saw a padlocked box nestled in among the others. Too tempting to pass up, I tugged at the damaged lock. It popped off with a snap, and the lid burst open. I was excited as I dug my hands into the box, hoping to find food or water or anything useful, but my excitement quickly died away. It was just a random assortment of odds and ends. Damn. I decided to be thorough and look through the box anyway. First thing to come out was a faded blue jumpsuit with the number 40 etched on the back. I threw it aside. It was worthless to me. Next was a broken radio, then some old photographs, too faded to make out, a toy car, a paint gun, several bobby pins, spent shotgun shells, and socks. Lots and lots of socks. Too many socks. A number of socks that made the number of pairs I had owned look deplorable. In a pseudo-rage, I flung the socks as far away from me as possible. I was reaching for more to throw when my hand hit something hard. There was something hidden beneath the socks. It was a computer, only smaller and attached to an oversized rubber bracelet with metal casings. The screen was dark, as there were three lights beneath it. A small gauge occupied the left-hand corner. A round dial sat a little lower. I lifted the device into the light so I could better examine it. Written in faded lettering were the words Pip-Boy Model 3000. My eyes drifted to the dark screen where eyes as gray as stone stared back at me in a strong, if weary, gaze. My own eyes. I was not one to gaze mindlessly at my own reflection for hours on end. I wasn't vain, or at least didn't think I was. But it had been quite some time since I had last looked myself over in a mirror. I examined my face using the Pip-Boy's reflected screen as a makeshift mirror. I still had the same yellow hair that hung limply from under my storm chaser hat, still had the freckles and crooked grin. The only difference I could discern was the sunburn and the excess grime. I smiled into the small computer screen and made a mental note to look for a toothbrush. I toyed with the Pip-Boy a bit longer, unsure of how to activate it. Still, it was an amazing discovery. A personal computer that one wore on their forearm. At least, that's what I assumed. The device could be something else entirely, for all that I knew. If I could just figure out how to turn it on. I decided to keep the Pip-Boy. It could prove useful, or at the very least entertaining. The problem was that I had nothing to carry it in. In my rush, I had forgotten to grab a bag and pack supplies, which had led to my predicament in the desert. Even if I did find something of value, I would need to be limited to what I could carry. I needed a bag. The suitcase came to mind. It had wheels, and I could easily rig it to close properly. As for the Pip-Boy, well, it was meant to be worn. I pulled back my shirt sleeve and squeezed my right hand through the bracelet. It was a snug fit, but my hand slid through. I held up my arm to examine it. It was on, but it felt off somehow. Like maybe I'd put it on wrong. Maybe it's broken. Sunlight reflected off of the screen as I turned my arm to examine the bracelet, creating spots of rainbow-colored light on the dusty floor. I turned my arm again, and the miniature rainbow darted away. Another movement brought the rainbow back, more vibrant than ever. I grinned. Even when powered down, the Pip-Boy was entertaining. For several minutes, I played with the Pip-Boy and the little rainbow, its light bouncing all around the shack. I was enthralled with its ability to change light into color, but I knew I had to continue searching for supplies. Strangely saddened by the rainbow's disappearance, I hopped down from the pallet, landing with a soft thud on my feet. Crash! The sound thudded throughout the ruined shack, sending me flailing to the floor in terror. Something had fallen and shattered nearby, something heavy and fragile, judging by the sound. I crawled over to the heap of boxes, doing my best to get close without being seen by whatever, or whoever, had knocked over the object. I stilled my breathing, tuning my ears to detect the most minute of sounds. The floorboards were creaking. There was the thud of heavy boots. Someone was here. A sense of joy I had not felt in some time washed over me like a waterfall. I felt like crying from pure happiness. After days of wandering alone in the desert, I had finally found another human being. I was saved. Or was I? My mind began to race with all the possibilities. I remembered the stories my mother had once told me of people who committed horrible crimes against one another. My mind returned to that day, the day when I had lost everything dear to me, the day the raiders had found our home. They had killed my parents in cold blood without a shred of mercy. They would have killed me too, or worse. I had been lucky that day, if you could say lucky. But just how far would my luck run? Would this person help me, or would they hurt me? It could be a raider or a slaver. I might be killed and eaten. What if I'm raped? What if it wasn't human? They could hurt me. They would hurt me. Panic set in. The rational me, who calmly searched for supplies, was gone, instead replaced by a child who had just seen the boogeyman. Unbridled fear took over. I did not want to die. My first instinct was to run, but what little rationality that remained in my head prevented me from doing so. The person could have a gun. I would only be an exposed target out in the desert. No, my best bet was to hide, to disappear. Making a snap decision, I slid under the pallet, crawling as far back into the shadows as I could, without making a sound. And then I waited, and I prayed. The thud of boots marched into the room just seconds after I had hid. The person was in no rush. I watched the worn leather boots move dully to the suitcase. A gloved hand bent down to retrieve the programmer's digest. My programmer's digest. The person then ambled over to the pallet. I held my breath. A boot knocked against the footlocker with a clang. Both hands came down to grip the pallet and struggled to lift it. The pallet remained where it was, far too heavy to be moved by anyone, so the person gave up. I relaxed.
All right, so, beloved star. Yeah, this was kind of long, but I have to admit, though, for this being as long as it is, this was really good.
Yeah, it kept me engaged up the whole entire time.
Yeah, at the 11-minute mark, I was like going, man, it's been playing for a while. It's like, yeah. Looked at it, it's like, oh, wow, it's been going on for 11 minutes. Wow, yeah. Dang.
I jumped when she said, crash. And I was like,
yeah.
Oh, gosh, what was that?
Yeah. So I have to admit, though, for this only being one person thing and just being a one narration thing, this was done really well. It was just phenomenally well done. I have to say congrats there, beloved star, but this was epic.
I liked it.
Yeah. So I got nothing else left. You?
Well, like I said, I love the characterization. You really had me going in the beginning. Like, you were just like, oh, like, just like her point of view. And like, when she's talking about death, your like heart just kind of like went out to her. I just wanted to pick her up and hold her and just be like, it's okay. And then, like, she went through it, and she went through the story, and it was, like I said before, it kept me engaged throughout the whole entire time, which is something really difficult to do. And I remember you contacted me, you're like, what's the maximum? Because mine's at 20 minutes right now, and I was like, too long. So I'm impressed that you were able to not only keep us engaged that amount of time, but you were able to cut it down so that you still had a good, substantial story. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, definitely have to say, definitely awesome story. I got nothing else left, do you? You?
Is that no?
Okay. Alright, so up next we have the last one up for tonight for the semifinals is Temporary Butterfly.
Dun, dun, dun.
So take it away whenever you're ready.
Steel Vengeance, Capital Wasteland, November 22, 1978. Come on, you assholes! We haven't got all day! Your new owners are waiting! The four slavers in mercenary garb were nervous, and had good reason to be. The Capital Wasteland was not so tolerant of their kind anymore since the destruction of Paradise Falls, and they knew it. Trouble was, the travel across the waste hadn't got that much safe in the last year, and it was painful, slow progress with the eight slaves. They'd hoped to be at the Pit Train Tunnel and home free by now. Due to a lot of rests and other problems, they'd only reached Northwest Seneca Station, and it didn't look like they were getting much further. As it turned out, they'd be getting no further. The Asian slaver at the back was in the act of kicking a slave who'd gone down exhausted when his head exploded. The second one next to him barely had time to realize this when a second shot rang out and he was catapulted backward several feet to land dead on his back. Aw, shit! It must be! A third shot literally cut off that sentence and the third one's head, leaving only the panicked leader pointing his assault rifle in every direction until a fourth shot blew his left arm off. Aw, fuck my arm! Guess we can call them MK2 Recon Armor a success, then. Leon Callan, the lone wanderer, turned off his new black armor stealth field a short distance away as he walked over to the awestruck slaves and started deactivating the cheap explosive collars they wore. It was a cross between the standard recon armor and combat armor, and better yet, had a stealth field incorporated into it. Coupled with the head-covering mask it had attached to the wearer, ended up looking like a modern-day ninja, and it made Leon a fearful sight to his enemies. Bastard! Oh, you're still alive? Leon spat at the slaver. I thought you fuckheads would have learned after what I did to Paradise Falls. The slaver's eyes became dinner plates. Aw, shit, you said it! Leon looked over the slaves, his eyes narrowing even further as he saw three of them were kids. Sorry. I can't give you everything you deserve, but this will have to do. The slaver didn't have time to scream before Leon's fifth shot shattered his head into bloody pieces. He spat on the corpse as he holstered his Blackhawk and went to by to escort the freed slaves safely back to Big Town. Next day, Citadel. GNR, Three Dog, all you need to know. Leon had switched on GNR to help pass the time while repairing his armor and several other suits down in the forge at the Citadel. The sore truth was he did everything and anything to pass time, so he didn't have to think that much anymore. It might have been the best year the Capital Wasteland had ever known, but for him, the last 6 months had been barely passable. He'd not heard anything from the Armada or Vault 101 since he'd put her in the overseer's seat, and Dogmeat had passed away in his sleep 2 months ago. Fox and Charon were living in the underworld and had their own lives to lead. Aside from his casual friends in Megaton and his comrades in the Brotherhood, he truly was the Lone Wanderer now, and he was starting to feel it. Although he's constantly coming up with new designs and weapons for the Brotherhood and doing wonders cleaning out the super mutants from the DC ruins, it felt like his life had lost any sense of direction. Now I know that I've been a little light on news lately, but we all know who's responsible for that, don't we, children? If Mr. 101 had never shown himself or simply didn't care, we'd be in one hell of a mess. As it is, we've got fresh water, a lot less jolly green giants, and best of all, no more enclave fascists. Leon smiled a little at that. The one bright spark was that no one had seen or heard anything at the enclave since he gave them a requiem at Adams Air Force Base. Either they had finally got the hint that their self-styled America wasn't wanted, or they'd simply died out. Leon, not surprisingly, was hoping for the latter. He'd never forgiven the Enclave for what they'd done, and nor would he ever. You're still working down here? Yes, I am, Sarah, Leon replied without looking around. And I'm going to be for a while yet. Sarah Lyon sighed. This isn't healthy, Leon. You can't spend the rest of your life fixing armor and being a one-man police force for the Wasteland. What am I supposed to do instead, then? You tell me. Try and live a little, Sarah advised. At least take it a little easier. Rothschild might appreciate you slaving away down here. We all appreciate you killing mutants in the day, but I know, Sarah, don't you think I know that? But I don't know how to do anything else, and I don't think I'm ready to live a little, as you put it yet. Well, if not now, when? Sarah's question was gentle, but it hit hard. Worse yet, she didn't have much of an answer either. She knew full well he didn't want to settle down any more than she did. Both of them were warriors and wouldn't give up that role. She also knew that he wasn't over Amata yet and not interested in looking for relationships elsewhere. Given these hard, cold facts, there were only one or two options left. I don't know. Well, if you're not ready to live yet, are you ready for a drink or two? You, me, some of the pride and paladin Tristan? How about it? Neon sighed indifferently. I was going home after finishing this all. Fine, then we'll have it in Megaton. Sarah's tone indicated he wasn't getting out of this. Finish up, clean up, and then make his topside. Consider that an order, Knight Commander. Neon seethed inside as she left, grinning. So much for a quiet night. Megaton. Moriarty was starting to think Christmas had come early. The Brotherhood platoon, consisting of Dusk, Glade, Kodiak, Vargas, Tristan, and Sarah, had gone through two rounds of drinks already, and they didn't look like slowing down. There was only one problem, at least as far as Sarah was concerned. Leon was a no-show at the bar. He'd come out of the Citadel without a complaint, went to his house to change clothes again once they'd arrived, and 30 minutes later, still nothing. If he thinks he's getting out of this, he's got another thing coming, Sarah thought darkly. She was halfway to the door, intent on dragging Leon there when he came on his own. But he certainly wasn't in a party mood as he was decked out in his customized hellfire armor and sporting his metal blaster. This made Leon look like he descended straight from the pits of hell. He'd taken a standard hellfire suit, emblazoned the Brotherhood logo into the arms of below the shoulders, and for psychological show, he'd riveted combat knife blades over the shoulder pads and down the front to his chest and from the elbows as well. He'd also replaced a standard helmet with a T-51B helmet, which he'd painted back. Most raiders ran clean away without a shot when they saw him in this suit. Leon, what are you... Sorry, Sarah. Party's going to have to wait. I've got a problem I need to take care of. What kind of problem? Sarah asked as the rest of the group came over to join them. In response, Leon punched several buttons on his pit boy. This is an emergency transmission from Vault 101. Leon, I hope you can hear this. I can understand if you never wanted to see me again, but I really needed your help. The Vault needs your help. We weren't ready for facing the outside world like you did, and we need you again. The code to the Vault door is now your name. The Vault needs a hero, and from now, what we've heard on GNR, you are one. Please help us, and come home. Leon turned off the message and snorted. Yeah, right, and I'm the next Enclave president. That was Amata, wasn't it? Sarah asked, starting to catch on. Yeah, but you heard her voice there. Someone was forcing her to say that crap, and given the way I left, do you really think she'd invite me back just like that? Leon looked around the table for opinions, and all he got were nods of agreement. So I'm going back, but it won't go the way they think it will. And if they've hurt Amata or anyone down there... Leon raised his hand and closed it into a fist for show. Good thinking, Paladin Tristan smiled at the man he mentored and considered the best the Brotherhood had. So what are we waiting for? Let's go kick some ass. Wait a minute, we? What do you mean, we? Leon was taken aback. You're one of us, kid, in case you hadn't noticed, Vargas chimed in. I don't know what things were like in that vault, but we look after our own. Too damn right. Count me in. Despite Leon's protests, every single one of the platoon was adamant about going on with him. As he thought more about it, the more he liked it. Whoever was pulling the strings down in the vault was expecting just him. When they'd get him... plus the Brotherhood's elite, enough to sterilize the vault 10 times over. Yes, he was starting to like this idea a lot. 5 minutes after collecting all their helmets and guns, they were on the road through Springfield. What kind of resistance should we expect? Tristan was asking. Leon scoffed. Pathetic. Cheap vault armor and cheap 10mm pistols. Raiders could do better than they've got. One or two of us could clean the place out without breaking a sweat. All that worries me is what's happened to Amata and the others in her group. Well, since this is your turf and your friends are involved, you can lead this up, Sarah suggested. Leon stared at her as though she'd gone mad. Me in charge of the pride? Speaking for myself, I'd follow you into hell. Leon waited for objection from the rest of the group. He was stunned when there wasn't any. and all the others just stared at him in any expectation, just waiting for his orders. Okay, fine. Helmets on. Let's do this.
Temporary butterfly! Alrighty. Well, I tell you, definitely improved. You did a lot of voices, or tried to ish. Some of them kind of work better than others. I don't know. What do you think?
Actually, I thought this was actually pretty good. You had a lot of emotion in there. You're definitely high on there. But your characterization really lacked.
Yeah.
It was like you just in a different...
It kind of felt more of like I was just hearing you reading it. Rather than you reading it. I don't know if, like, you can sense that difference.
Basically, there was, like, absolutely no characterization. There was just you.
Yeah.
And different inflections.
And I can hear the attempts at the voices. So, like, there were some that I could tell that definitely, you know, like, there was a character that kind of seemed a little bit kind of like your personality kind of thing. I could hear that in your voice a bit better, like if your voice just fit it more. But there's some characters it didn't really work with.
Yeah.
And I felt that if you really had played up some of their characteristics, you could have maybe succeeded more in that aspect.
Also, some of your storytelling, too. You seemed like you stumbled on a few words, too.
I mean... And this is something that's new for most people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're going to have words, stumble, and whatnot, but...
Other than that, other than the nitpicking that we put in there...
Yeah, other than
I've got nothing else. This is actually really good.
You improved definitely from when we first had you on Tell Your Tales oh so many moons ago. Shut up. Many moons have passed within that year.
Yeah, so. I got nothing else left, you?
Nope.
All right, so we get to... So we'll be back to tell people who is moving on to the finale. And so we will be right back after this discussion. All right, everybody, and welcome back to the results.
Oh my goodness!
So, Olivia, so without further ado, we got two spots left in the finale. Would you like to fill up one of them?
Of course. Oh my goodness. So, for tonight, Zane and I both picked the same person. You really blew it away.
Yes.
Beloved Star, you got it this week. I mean, not only did you do, like, a ridiculously long entry, but you did it in a way that kept us listening. And you did it really well. So I'm proud of you. Good job.
Yes. Yes.
So Zane.
Yes.
We don't have a bottom two. Because no. This week we had everyone did really well. It's just kind of like, who's the last slot going to?
Yeah. So with a lot of debate and, well, a lot of everything, trying to figure out who would be the best one, not just to go up against this, but who did the best tonight. Who and Temporary Butterfly, I'm sorry, but the Artichoke is going to move on to the finals. I'm sorry, Temporary Butterfly, but he edged you out just a teeny, it's just so sliver of a margin. There's a point one thing going on there.
Yeah, like you guys both did really well tonight. The Artichoke.
Yeah, and Temporary Butterfly, you did probably one of the best I've actually heard you do in a while.
This is actually the best I've heard you at, and I don't want you to feel disappointed or not proud. You got to the semifinals, and I think that you definitely should be proud of that. Yeah. Thank you so much for being on this show.
Mm-hmm. Because you did awesome this week. Awesome this year. Sorry, my bad. You made it farther than anybody else who dropped or got kicked off. So, yeah. That was out of, what, 12 people?
I believe so.
So you made it top 3 out of 12 people, so that is an accomplishment right there.
Indeed. And?
So talking about the finale.
Finale.
Would you like to say what's going to one of the rounds we're going to have?
Yes. Okay, so Zane and I decided that we were going to split it up via kind of like a type. So we chose a cartoon, a live action, and a book.
Yes.
As the themes for these fan fictions. Yes.
And Olivia chose the anime. I mean, not the anime, but the cartoon.
It is an anime.
Yes.
Zane chose the live action, and we both came to a consensus on the book.
Yes.
So
would you like to say what the cartoon is?
Of course. The anime cartoon that I chose was Ouran High School Host Club. I want some pretty boy love, okay? So, give me that. All
right. You know, if there's anything else that's awkward in this thing, I'll come back to you. All right. And for the live action, I decided to go with Chuck. Yes. Nothing beats nerd action with spies. That doesn't sound as bad as it actually is. Wait, no. I mean, I'm tired.
Yes.
I can't form words and sentences. Alright, so would you like to say what the book is?
Okay, so the book. This book was the pinnacle of founding almost anything that we know about modern fantasy. So, I want you all to do us proud with Lord of the Rings.
Yay!
I'm so excited. And also, I want to hear some good goblin voices.
Yes.
You guys can do it.
Because it's very, very nice indeed.
Yes.
I'm just kidding. You don't have to do a goblin voice because I know that I for sure can't. Anyway, so like we said, themes are Ouran High School Host Club, Chuck, Lord of the Rings.
And you guys will have, and Bluffs are the art joke, you will have 2 weeks to do them.
Mm-hmm.
So they aren't going to be due till like the 20th.
Yeah.
That means we're off for 2 weeks. We're off for a week. Yay! Party!
Woohoo!
And you know what this means, though, don't you? It means the season's coming to an end.
Oh my goodness. It's been a long run.
Hey, you know what that means, right? We actually get a badge.
Let's get to the finale first. Anyway, yeah. Everybody, good night.
Night.